But first, Bruce Sterling and Yasmina Tasanovic are what you might call an internet power couple. Both born in 1954, Bruce in Texas and Yasmina in Belgrade in former Yugoslavia. He became one of the founders of the cyberpunk literary revolution, which is a meld of sci-fi and pop culture and technology. And while continuing to write novels and non-fiction about the future, with a degree of prescience, as it turned out, he then spearheaded a digital environmental movement called the Viridian Greens, which aims to cast global warming as a design problem which technology can solve, as opposed to technology being the problem. Meanwhile, Yasmina Tasanovic, a Serbian writer and filmmaker, was living in Belgrade when the Serbs were on the rampage in Kosovo and NATO was bombing Belgrade, 1999. She kept a journal and emailed excerpts to a friend in Sweden, and soon it was on the web, it was everywhere, and the journals ended up being published in a book called The Diary of a Political Idiot. Bruce Sterling and Yasmina Tasanovic are in New Zealand for the Webstock conference, and I suggested to Yasmina that writing her journal was a bit of a lifesaver for her.
I'm not sure it saved my life, you know, but I'm sure it saved my psychological life, you know, because the thing is, it happened that we were completely cut off by material stuff, like we didn't have phones, we didn't have electricity, you know.
The sanctions were in operation.
The sanctions were in operation like 15 years before of that, you know. And also we didn't have books, meaning sanctions means you don't have books, you don't have any information. That's why my book is called Diary of a Political Idiot, you know, because we all became political idiots and idiots, generally speaking, because, you see, we're idiot in the Greek sense of the word, you know, it means lack of information, you know, so people who lack information, they just become people who are not responsible for what's happening in political life, you know. And in that sense, I was online ever since the early 90s because it was the only way of getting in touch with what was happening, not only outside my country, but inside my country, you see. So when I say it saved my life, actually it saved my mind, you know, and in that sense, probably it saved other people's lives, you see, because we could communicate, I could write, and I could tell other people what was going inside and what was going outside, so many people could take decisions which were proper, which are not dictated from inside by a dictator, you know, like Milosevic was, or outside, but just complete, they were ignoring us, you know, the Western world was just putting us under sanctions, and that's it. You know?
I was just thinking, and I'm obviously not comparing the two of you, but I'm thinking of Diary of Anne Frank, right? Yeah. It took years and years to get out. Mm-hmm. You, in real time, mm-hmm. were telling people what it was like to be there.
Yeah, that was like, I think my war diary was the first one of the sort. I didn't know it until a couple of years ago, you know, because it was like, you see, my only problem, I was lucky to have a laptop, you see, and a laptop means that it had batteries, you know, because we didn't have power very often, mm-hmm. and so I would just run without my laptop from one power place to another, from one part of the city to another, because it was bombed like random, first one place then the other. So I could write immediately stuff, and I wasn't sure that they would get it and who were going to get it, you know, because I didn't have immediate feedback, you know. And when people started telling me they were getting it, you know, it, at that point, as you said before, it might have happened that it did save my life, because I became all of a sudden famous, but not famous as an anonymous person.
Anonymously famous.
Yeah.
In order to protect you under the Milosevic regime.
Yes, that was a very good protection, because at that point I asked people who were publishing my diary to put my name, not to take it away, because in order to protect them, they took it away. And I said, no, I'm protected much better as a dissident living under bombings, you know, under interior repression, basically, not only bombings, that they won't, you know, do anything to me because I have this feedback from the world. So, you know, this is like one of the good things about internet, that sometimes really it can
Draw attention, yes, which protects.
Yes. Right. And people can, you know, it's really, nobody censors it. I mean, yes, of course, we have now censorship of all sorts, like many years afterwards, you know. But at that point, you don't have an editor who censors you. You don't have, like, you know, a magazine or something, you know, a radio or whatever, you know. It just goes, you are your own, you know, editor.
At the point where you were writing your journal and sending it out, what were you doing, Bruce?
Reading the journal.
And did you know each other?
No. Not a bit of it.
So you were sitting in where? Austin, Texas?
Yes, I was in Austin, Texas as a journalist and futurist. And, of course, I immediately recognized when this war diary was appearing that it was one of the new things on the Internet. And, of course, in the late 90s, people were very interested.
You mean a new genre?
Well, it's more like a new social phenomenon. I mean, in a way, it's a thing beyond writing. I mean, the raw immediacy of this sort of woman's reportage on the ground really didn't feel much like a diary. I mean, diaries like the Diary of Pepys or the Diary of Anne Frank really are kind of a genre, personal confessions over a long period. But you know the outcome.
Right.
I mean, you know Anne dies in the camp. You know that Pepys has been dead for 400 years.
That's right.
Here is a, you know, it's more a blogger-style warfare current events narrative where you could write in and sort of say what was going on, or you could act to distribute it to people in your own circle on the Internet, which, of course, I did.
So you read it, and then you circulated among your network.
That's
and
correct.
Presumably they did the same thing, and so
yes,
on and so forth.
Yes, it spread virally, as they like to say.
So that's the technological aspect of it. What were you thinking when you read it?
Well, I just really wanted to understand what was going on. I mean, I'm kind of a student of the Eastern Bloc. I've traveled in Russia and in Poland and Czechoslovakia, and I used to do that for Wired magazine in San Francisco. They sent me to Moscow, to St. Petersburg, to Prague, and I was kind of interested in that. And I was always keenly interested in Yugoslavia because in the events of 1989, it was the worst-case scenario. I mean, none of the other sort of ex-communist countries were breaking out in these kinds of violent shooting wars. And I thought I would understand the transition countries better if I looked directly at sort of what was going on and the sort of worst of the pack. And there are those who say I got a little too close to my material.
How did you get close?
I'm a journalist and Yasmin is a activist and also writes for magazines.
I think you could call yourself an activist now too, couldn't you?
I suppose I could, but people don't call me that. And they do call me a journalist and I get paid to be a journalist. And when I was in journalism school, they always told me not to do that.
Right. Yeah,
you were obviously
very obedient then.
Well, it's unethical,
yeah.
You know, to take sides on the page. I mean, if I were in the times that I've been writing about Serbia, I don't do it that rarely. I don't take any pronounced political stance there.
Well, I think
in green technology, I'm an activist.
I think among us, we can share the opinion that Slobodan Milosevic was a complete bastard, can't we?
Absolutely.
You know,
I really am.
Oh, no, yeah. Bruce is upset sitting on the fence on this one.
There's a third of the population in Serbia that thinks the guy was a martyr.
But that's not a ridiculous point of view, isn't it?
No more ridiculous than the third of the American population who thinks Bush did no wrong.
All right. Well, let's explore this for a moment. By you taking a completely objective view and saying he could have been a martyr or he could have been a complete bastard, where does that... What do you think, Yasmin?
Oh, I think it's outrageous what he's saying right now. You see, because
one-third of the people think he wasn't a complete bastard doesn't mean that they're not stupid and misguided people. Otherwise, Bruce, what are you going to tell me? This is going to get me in serious talk. Are you going to tell me creationism is okay because a certain number of people in the United States believe in it?
Well, I don't want to preach moral relativism here, but the creationists are a very powerful political force in the United States. They hit way above their weight.
That's not what I asked.
Well, if you're trying to understand how events are going to play out, it doesn't help to make these kinds of across-the-board judgments.
All right.
I mean, you really have to understand that they're there. They're not going away. That's what they truly and sincerely believe, and they are powerful.
Isn't that kind of moral relativism what worries people about the internet? I'm stretching here, but the internet can be a use for extraordinary good or extraordinary bad, and to a lot of people it seems like mayhem, it seems like cacophony, where everybody's voice has the same weight as everybody else's voice, even if they're, you know, a mad genocidal person. Do you know what I mean?
There I know exactly what you mean. And, you know, I've seen that sort of play out both ways. I mean, maybe in the very early days of the internet, there was that kind of democratization where, you know, you could be a Serbian activist and you meet some American cyberpunk science fiction writer and it's just sort of fine and kind of, you know, you're meeting on a sort of common ground there. And the contemporary internet, if you're a blogger like I am for Wired.com or like Yasmin is for BlogB82.com, we actually are an internet power couple to the extent that there was not really internet power in the early days of that medium. Mm. I mean, there's been a big shakeout on the internet, and now it has peaks and valleys pretty much like any other means of communication.
I'm not sure that that makes me feel any better about it, and I'm sure you're not interested in that. But
I wish I could spend my entire time reassuring you. You know, if I was the kind of guy
you
who
are not,
sought
I knew you weren't going to reassure me.
If I was
me.
The kind of guy who sought reassurance, I would not be involved with the woman to my right here.
No,
I'm
how?
Sorry.
Okay, let's get back to the story. How did you become involved in the woman on your right?
Well, I was just very interested in what she was doing.
Yes, all right. But, I mean, did you ring her up?
For heaven's
sake. No,
Yasmina. Tell me about it.
Well, he was
clearly,
right.
This should be good.
He can't string two words together here.
Because he wrote me an email saying, like, at a certain point I was in personal danger, you know, and I wrote a letter, and before Milosevic fell. And then he wrote me and said, are you okay? And he sent me, like, his, and I said, who are you? I thought he was, like, creep from Texas, you know, cyberpunk. I never
creep
read science
from
fiction,
Texas.
You know. I,
that's him.
I was like, you know, because he sent me his website, and I was like, oh, these people are playing wars, you know, while we're doing real wars, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was like, I didn't really realize, I didn't know of him, but, you know, I didn't have time to know that because I was really in bad situations. But he was really, really nice towards me. And then he, like, do you really need help? You know, this is like, I appreciate very much because, you see, wars are really very boring, you know.
Yeah, tell me about that. I know that you said this, and it strikes me as a very interesting comment.
Well, because, you see, things is that everybody thinks that wars are very exciting, that things happen all the time, but things don't happen. You know, this is the point of modern wars. Nothing happens all the time, and you're sitting there, maybe you'll be dead, maybe something will hit you. There is nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. You know, it's like, it's not like you can be active about it. You know, I was an activist as a woman in black on the very first day, but I was also a writer, a filmmaker, you know, a mother. You can't be a mother. You can't be a filmmaker. You can't be a writer. You can be only an activist standing in the street and every day risk your life, you know, and that's really boring. You know, it's like, and that's and what I liked about his letter was that he was offering help. You know, he was offering, and I had like three of those letters from many fan letters I had in my life, you know, at that period, you know. But only three of them, one from Italy, one from Belarus, and another one like from Sweden. They asked me, do you need a visa? Do you need protection? You know, do you need something concrete? You know, because, and this is like really, it showed that he was an activist after all.
And
know?
Was there any help that Bruce could offer you at that
well,
point?
Well, yes, publicity. Yeah, I could get a visa from my Italian friend, but I could get publicity. I mean, like spreading through the internet, you know, what was going on, as I told you before, that was really, that was true help. And that's the power of internet now that we're talking about. That was the power of information, of the good side of it.
Nevertheless, I mean, you know, the whole world knows about you, but there you are, you and your, 15-year-old daughter, stuck in Belgrade being bombed.
Yes.
I mean, did you think you were going to get out? Let me ask you this, because it's an interesting point that you've mentioned. There must have been people in Belgrade who did not like Milosevic, such as yourself, who in some peculiar way welcomed the bombing as a way to bring an end to him. Would that at all be the case?
I welcomed the bombing because I thought there would be much better bombings, you know, because I believe in something like humanitarian bombings, really. I did, because I thought it would last 3 days or 7 days and they're going to target what they should target, like his house, you know, his hiding places and all that. No, they did some kind of symbolical bombings, like we went for 3 months.
To pretend that they were doing something.
Yes,
you
mean. I mean, like to make people vote something else or what, you know, and finally they left us with destroyed cities, destroyed bridges, destroyed country, radioactive places, you know, cluster bombs all over the place, people dying like crazy of fear or like sicknesses, you know. And
right
with
idea,
Milosevic
wrong
in
way.
Power.
Okay.
And Milosevic still in power. You know, it was
not
really,
for long, though.
Yeah.
Not
well,
for long.
Not for long. It was a lousy bombing, however. And not for long because only afterwards, for the first time, they financed, I mean, the Western countries, they financed concretely the opposition movements. Oh. It started like in beginning of June after the end of the bombings for the first time, and it happened through American embassy in Budapest, you know, like Otpor, resistance movements of young people, and the democratic parties were all underground and completely, you know, penniless for the first time. The diplomacy, the world diplomacy didn't play the diplomatic double games, you know, like on one side we will support you, on the other side we will, you know, do that kind of stuff.
Okay, so Bruce, you said you want help, and she said yes, and make this public, and you made it public. And when did you first meet?
We actually first met in Turin, where we now live. But how long had that been? Three years, four years?
We didn't meet for 1 year and a half. He was writing a book at that point on Serbia. Mm-hmm. So he asked me to help him with
Did you start writing your book on Serbia before or after you made contact with Yasmin?
Well, I was very interested in the situation on the ground there. And I knew what was going on in Yugoslavia. I mean, that's one reason why I was one of the first people to read her diaries, that I had a journalistic interest in what was going on there. But we were just trading data about what was going on. I mean, the country was under sanctions. It was difficult to get any news of what was going on. There was tremendous propaganda wars going on at the time from every ethnic group, every major power. And it was very interesting to, you know, hear something so street level and immediate and sort of focused on the everyday that appealed to the novelist side in me. And I was writing, you know, a book about the future, a book called Tomorrow Now. And a section in this book was about warlordism and state failure. So I know a lot about that topic. And, it happened. It happened in the Balkans. I once met the prime minister of Yugoslavia, and he said, "You're a science fiction writer." Well, he was, yes, prime minister of Serbia and Montenegro at the time. Maybe even the rump Yugoslavia, I'm not sure. But he asked me why, as a science fiction writer, I was so interested in the Balkans. And I said it was because they had more future than they could consume locally, and they were going to give it to everybody else. And, you know, in point of fact, since that time, there has been a globalization of Balkanization.
Balkanization of the globe.
Well, it's one of Yasmina's favorite taglines. Yes, it is a Balkanization of the globe.
You see, in what way?
Well, just consider the situation in Iraq or the situation in Afghanistan, where you've got failed states, endless ethnic warfare, lots of ethnic cleansing. I mean, the mayhem in Iraq makes the mayhem in Yugoslavia look quite civilized and low-key, really.
And so what is this, post-9/11?
No, I think it's a deeper thing than that. It's actually kind of a crisis in the Westphalian system. It's a crisis of globalization, basically. It's a, you know, it's a weakness in a globalized society that can finance everything but can't govern anything. You know, governance is local, but finance, arms, small arms, human trafficking, narcotics, and these other destabilizing forces are very porous, and they spread as quickly as the internet does.
In an attempt to find good news in that, how's Belgrade now?
Well, I'm quite the fan. I mean, I really consider Belgrade my second spiritual home in many ways. And, you know, I write
very... Where's your first spiritual home?
Well, Austin, Texas.
Okay.
That's where I'm from. I'm a native Austinite, and, you know, I've lived there almost 30 years. But, you know, I went to Belgrade, and you would think of it from the way I describe it as a very dark and gloomy and morbid and war-torn society. But, you know, on the contrary, you know, it's a society which has suffered a lot, but it's a society that's known a lot of suffering. And I actually feel quite at home there. I mean, the ability of people in Balkan society to deal with crises that would just cripple or maim people in other societies is something I respect very much.
Does that not do something to them, though? How does a society emerge?
It makes them. It makes them what they are.
Yasmina, you remember Belgrade before and after. Mm-hmm. Milosevic was presumably both a cause and an effect in some peculiar way. Yeah. What's your reading of it now? Has it been traumatized? And
it crippled us. You know, it crippled. I can see the children. You know, my daughter's now a little bit more grown up. You know, she's a grown up woman now. But I see her generation, and she was a war child. She started going to school with Milosevic in power, meaning terrible stuff, like having refugees in the class, suffering hunger. She had an operation without anesthetics, you know, because it was an urgent case. She couldn't buy, like, toys. We couldn't buy shoes, you know. And we just come from a normal class, you know, like a middle class. And if we were in that situation, it means everybody was. Now. And it was kind of nice that everybody was in the same situation. Now, we learned a lot of stuff like sharing, solidarity. There are secondhand effects of wars, which are good, and especially in Serbian
community
people.
Building exercise.
Absolutely. I discovered the thing, that, especially among Serbian people, that they have solidarity. They're nationalists, they're strong-headed, they're completely, they're very stubborn. This is things I hate. They're patriarchal.
This is your experience, please.
I think that the Serbs are motivated by spite. I mean, not exactly spite.
No, but
in
hang
English,
on a minute. When you say they call Serbs, what do you mean when you say Serbs? Is Yasmina motivated by spite?
Yeah, she's got Serbian qualities, and so does her daughter, whom I know very well, my stepdaughter. And as a mother, she's weeping in her beer about her daughter's difficult upbringing. But I actually have very positive feelings about young people in Serbia. I think they're very well equipped to deal with the consequences, say, of a massive global financial crash. They're going to be much more at home. I mean, compared to other oppressed groups around the world, I've seen many. I used to live in India. I've traveled. I've seen these things. There are people in the South Bronx and East Los Angeles much worse off than Serbs. There are people in, we don't even count Central Africa, but, really, they're maybe a third of the planet's population is objectively much worse off than Serbs.
But what I think it's not like you can't compare like this.
No, exactly.
They're a very lively, resilient bunch. And it's true that the 90s were tough for Belgrade, but World War I was tough for Belgrade.
I know,
World War II was tough for Belgrade. 400 years of Ottoman domination was tough for Belgrade. Losing the war in 1370 something was, they have a list of grievances. There's not a day unstained on their calendar.
Well, because this is a reading of a futurist or whatever.
But that's how I see reality. They're not a broken people.
But hang on a minute. You keep saying they.
Yes.
But are you excluding Yasmina from this?
It's us. For me, it's us.
I'm Serbski Zet for all our Serbian listeners. I'm a relation.
Yeah, he's a Serb. You see, when I made this movie,
I married into the clan.
When I made this movie during the bombings, which ended up in the Venice Film Festival, was shooting during the bombings every day. And it ended up all over the world in the Venice Film Festival, which is like a very fancy place. And you know what was the reaction of all these fancy people, from actors to directors? They expected that Belgrade was a village where we were like dressed in this peasant, and the bombs were falling. And this is the prejudice that we were talking about here now from Bruce, to the third world, even though we're in the middle of the world.
It isn't prejudice.
It's not, okay. We're the fourth world. But the thing is that that we're amazed to see was that it's a big city just like Paris. It has skyscrapers and people are walking the streets and it's a 3 million city, and that people are dressed normally like Western Europe and that they were bombed. It wasn't like some villages or mountains were random bombed, and we were living in caves, This was it, that they were that the people watching them said it could happen to anybody.
Well, I think that was why the whole Balkan conflict shocked a lot of people to whom another wave of starvation from Africa has ceased to mean a great deal because they were people like us,
yes,
so-called. Mm. And so the identification was poignant, wasn't it? Don't you think?
It depends on how old you were. I mean, if you survived World War II, there's nothing going on in the Balkan conflict of the 90s that would surprise you.
Mm. Do you think that the increasing globalization, then the increasing use of the internet, the increasing, personal witness and dialogue between people from disparate backgrounds and from disparate nationalities is eventually going to break down the kind of nationalism, Bruce, that you were talking about before?
Well, it's certainly broken a lot of previous institutions and, it's trying to build new ones, but we're breaking them a lot faster than we're building them.
Well, is breaking them a start? Is it a good start? Or is it more bad than good?
Speaking of historically, you could say all kinds of kindly things about creative destruction.
Yeah.
I mean, Serbia is a different country than the communist Yugoslav regime. From the breakup of the Balkans, I mean, it's sort of across the board. If you're Slovenian, man, things are great. It's like it's just been sort of one long series. Now you're in Schengen, you've got the euro, you get to travel to all these capitals that were previously closed to you. You've got clothing, you've got food, you've got internet access, information. You can travel all over this continent. You're a European. It's worth it. If you're in Bosnia-Herzegovina, you're in a place that's just a political and economic basket case and really a very slim chance of things getting better. I mean, you're going to send your child out of the country if you can. You're going to get out of the country if you can. Your daily life is full of menace. It's gloomy. Serbia looks much better than them. I mean, Serbia was the dominant one among the Yugoslav republics. It's in a tough area, but, you know, that's just a tough area of the world.
What do you think? What's your experience of Belgrade now, Yasmina?
Yeah, well, you know, in the past few years, maybe it's a little bit better. Unfortunately, the minister Zoran Djindjic, who was murdered. He was, you know, a friend of mine too, you know, so personal friend, so I knew him. And he was our best and only chance, you know. The regime we have now, it's a little bit better than the one we had before. But, you know, this story, this nationalist Kosovo story, that's going to kill us. You know, it's like going on and on. And now the integration of Serbia into Europe has been stopped again because what they do in the United Nations is claim territory of Kosovo, you know, which is some kind of fixation. Oh. You know, I don't know. Nobody of us ever went to Kosovo.
So you're with Bruce on that. You know, you're going back God knows how many hundred years to state your claim in Kosovo. That doesn't make much sense
now. You know, I don't think it's what Bruce is talking about. It might be from point of view of somebody looking outside. Oh. I think it's a topic which is being manipulated by the politicians. It's a good, you know, it's like conflicts are very often used in order to put the people on one side, you know, and not to face. For example, the Kosovo topic, what it is doing at this point is putting Serbian people on one side against the fact and acknowledgement that, for example, Serbian army committed genocide in Srebrenica in Bosnia. So they're living in denial, you know, because they're all against Serbian people together, against this new war they're waging, which is now called diplomatic war, instead of facing what really happened in the past 15 years and going ahead.
How comfortable is it for you then to go back there and speak out about all this? Can you do that?
Oh, it's extremely uncomfortable and unpleasant. I'm notorious. You know,
it's probably a bit like Bruce going back to Texas and saying Bush is an idiot.
It's a bit more. It's more like hanging out with a Jane Fonda figure. I mean, no, Yasmina is a feminist peacenik in a very masculine, very war-oriented society that's got grudges going back 700 years.
Interesting position.
Well, you know, I don't want to come across as the optimist Pollyanna figure here.
Well, you haven't so far, but give it another go.
It never suits my temperament. But, you know, I happen to think that the current honcho in Serbia, Boris Tadic, is a much more gifted politician than Zoran Djindjic. And there's not just one great political hope. I mean, you know,
what do you mean when you say a gifted politician?
No, he's really a capable administrator, and he's got a lot of political skill. I mean, he's facing a desperate situation, but, you know, it's been desperate in that region for quite a while. I think Tadic and the people within his court have the upper hand in Serbian politics right now, which Djindjic never achieved.
Is it fair to say that you both want to change the world? I mean, this is a stupid question, really. I suppose everybody does to a certain extent, right, but in a broader sense than most people.
You know, I like to watch the parade. I mean, the things that I find of tremendous interest are not things that individuals can do a lot about. It's things like the spread of English. You know, the spread of English is changing the world. It's been going on for 400 years. It's probably going to go on another 400 years. There's no amount of activism, fundraising, effort I can do that would stop the spread of English.
No, but you do seem that you do seem to believe that there is some level of activism you can do to affect our progress towards serious climate change.
You know, well, yeah. I mean, you know, there are certain efforts that I feel sort of morally obliged to speak out about. I mean, everybody in my family, we're all Texans, and we were all oil company people. You know, and the fossil fuels industry is killing the planet. I mean, just sort of straight out. It's like those people in Victoria, the 189 of them who died under
200
just
actually.
Well, I don't
last
know what
count.
I shudder at the thought of the body count, you know, and I shudder at the body counts to come. You know, the climate in Australia has been destabilized. It's close to the South Pole. You know, that continent is a rim of green on a vast desert. It's one of the most imperiled ecological regions on Earth.
All right. Well, your argument then, and the usual environmental argument, just to stereotype it, is to move away from overconsumption and consequently away from technology and modernity to some extent. I don't want to overstate that, but that's the general thrust of it. Yours is quite the opposite. Yours is that technology can fix it.
I think people mistake modernity for 20th century modernism. the ways we used to do things in the 30s, the 40s, the 20s, you know, maybe up to the oil crisis of the 70s. That stuff's as dead as mutton. I mean, it's as dead as the Victorian steam engine. There's no arts and crafts way out of this where we go back to our hand looms and our goats. I mean, that's just done. So, you know, we've got to come up with a 21st century infrastructure. I mean, go read worldchanging.com if you're interested in this. These are guys who are pals of mine, have set up a website I consider just fabulous. I mean, that was something I was really futuristic about. You just look at like this Obama stimulus plan. Oh, my gosh, it's about to rain green on Austin, Texas right now. There's going to be wall-to-wall solar and windmills down there. There's going to be a tornado of green energy deep in the heart of Texas. And there are guys with their 10-gallon hats out just waiting to catch that federal money. You know, and I know those guys, and I don't want to get in their way.
So this is a good thing, you're saying, or this is a bad thing?
I'm saying it's a colossal thing.
Well, whatever. Is it good in terms of global warming?
All right, try and imagine a green energy company that's as big as BP, you know, or Shell Oil, or, you know, one of these other major enterprises. You know, I mean, most people who are anti-technological green activists would find that a scary idea. I mean, they just don't like big companies.
Or they could say leopards don't change their spots.
Well, you know, you could say anything from a political perspective about how you disagree with modernity. You know, if that's the case, you ought to go join an ashram. A lot of people do that. They last maybe 18 months if they're really tough. And then they sort of go around and walk around sheepishly making, you know, political gestures about their paper bags and plastic bags. That's got nothing to do with the situation we're actually in. And it's certainly going to not stop anybody in Victoria from catching on fire. Mm. You know, the wolf is at the door. You know, it's going to be time for scythe and pitchforks there. There's not a whole lot that a science fiction novelist can do about this. I mean, I had my Cassandra moment. Like every futurist in the world, I knew climate change was coming. I've been writing about it since the early 1980s. Every scientist in the world and the IPCC has been hammering some podium about this. Every political leader knows. You know, what can I tell you? I'm doing something else right now.
What else are you doing?
Well, I'm very interested in design theory generally. So I'm doing a book about design theory.
With a view to reducing the chances of global meltdown.
You know, I'm a futurist, and, you know, I think the futurist is a guy who gives in February. I mean, everybody gives in Christmas, you know, because that's when you give. And I give in February when nobody's paying attention to particular issues. And, you know, I feel like I'm doing my job when I'm doing it 10 months ahead of everybody else. Maybe 8, 7 years, that's a good span for me. I mean, I was an environmental activist 10 years ago. Now it's a very mainstream thing to be. It's about to be a mainstream corporate global thing to be.
So you're moving on.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm just trying to dig deeper. I just want to find the determining forces there. I mean, why is the world the way it is?
What does the global economic recession signal?
I could go on all day about
it. I'm sure you could. I'm sure he could. What does the global economic recession signal? Is that good news or bad news? What is it?
You know, if you're going to do a geopolitical thing about it, well, it's bad news. Of course, a depression is
immediately bad news.
You know, it's immediately bad news.
Of course.
But it's also the end of business as usual, which is good news because business as usual is fatal.
Well, that's why I wondered whether you thought that it had in some perverse way a good news attached to it because it's going to force people to change their attitudes. Or is it? I don't know.
Well, it certainly will. But, you know, it's not good to see the situation spinning out of control as badly as it did. I mean, it's, you know, what can I say here? If you were into geopolitical theory, people used to talk a lot in the 90s during the Clinton administration about the Washington Consensus, which was kind of global neoliberal capitalism and kind of, you know, shrinking the state, privatizing things, getting market forces to help and so forth. Okay, what just happened was the death of that doctrine. It just died. And since I'm an American, I naturally think Washington ought to be telling everybody else how to live. Okay, that's not going to work. That's just not going to work because that consensus just got strung up by the heels in public. Mm. Now, what's the new consensus look like? I don't have a clue. And not only that, I don't know anybody who does.
You're the futurist here, Bruce. What can
well,
I say?
You know, we're just like open Pandora's box here. Yeah. Things are going to get mighty weird. I mean, mighty weird. So weird you might have like a Trotskyite postman being president of France.
Oh, that's a possibility.
You know, postmen aren't supposed to be presidents of France. We just had like a black guy elected the president of the United States. That's supposed to be politically unthinkable. There's a lesbian running Iceland. Every person in Iceland owes $300,000 in international debt. Every man, woman, and child, every retiree. It's over.
Yeah, I wouldn't believe that if you wrote about it, though. It's
well,
too
you
mad.
Know, and those are pretty small potatoes compared to the unbelievable developments which are sort of just over the horizon.
Yasmina, what's your abiding interest now, apart from arguing with Bruce,
you know,
I suspect?
Well, you know, what's happening to all of you, I guess, or the Western world, or, you know, the capitalism, it happened to us, you know. So, I mean, in a different way and in a small scale, you know.
Yeah.
It was kind of, but, you know, I've been there. And
yes.
I'm kind of bored with this situation. We already lost everything, and I have nothing to lose, and I'm bored with this new, you know. You know what I'm trying?
I was interested to know your take on that, actually, because you're looking at people saying, oh, my gosh, you know, I've lost my job. And you're thinking, job? You should be so lucky.
Yeah, I lost everything. I lost the houses. I come from a quite wealthy family, you know. But the interesting thing is that my mother lost it, you know, in her generation. My grandfather lost it. Like, every generation of people who live in the territory of Serbia lose everything. That's very interesting. We'd never make it to the second generation. We can't inherit. You know, we just lose it, you know. So, but anyway, I don't care about that anymore so much. I think it's just big fuss and you know, I really believe that something good is going to happen there, you know, like American consumerism is going to stop finally, you know. Really, I mean, it was not, and not to speak about economic point of view, but it takes you to, you know, but it, on the global level, I mean, it's certain parts of the planet are exploited in order for the other people just to grow disproportionately. I think it's something anesthetic to look at, you know. I mean, it was degenerative to look at American people in this consumer, you know, which was like they were growing fat, you know, they were unhappy. They were, you know, they were using the cars as if they didn't have legs, you know, really. I've noticed it. Like, and I really love America.
Of course,
you know.
Did live in Los Angeles,
yeah,
ladies
yeah.
and gentlemen.
But, I love America from many point of view. I like rock culture. I like individualistic culture. I grew up in Italy and I hated the tradition. You know, the traditional European countries are very oppressive, you know. I like very many aspects.
The new world.
Yeah, the new world. I like that, you know. And the people from all over the world that come and speak many languages. This is my sort of, you know, world where I love to live. But I've seen this kind of country go down. And, and I'm happy that now finally there is a diagnosis, you know, whatever, you know, from futurists or. And what I'm interested in now is like, but history has taken over so many years of my life, you know. And
You think you wasted them?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to waste anything because I kind of use everything. You know, bad news are very good for writers, you know. Although
it's like bad childhoods.
Yeah, well,
fantastic.
Yeah. Absolutely, you know, and it's like, but you know what I would really like to is to try, because I wrote about mermaids and I made movies which were not necessarily unhappy, you know, and I would really like to go back to that kind of, you know, to write something which
literature.
Is
literature. She's talking about literature,
I don't believe in literature
rather than
anymore.
Politics.
Yeah, I don't believe in literature.
Well, and the internet's perfect for you.
Yeah, I think the internet's perfect for me, but I don't want to be this voice, you know, always like Cassandra voice, always speaking about, you know. Although, you know, it seems to come back all the time to me, you know, because people just, I know something because I've been there, you know. So people like just, now my last book is on this genocide trial, you know, and it's been published and it's going to be published. And people ask me about genocides. All of a sudden, I'm a genocide expert. I didn't want to be a genocide expert. It was just in my house. I noticed,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This is it. You know?
No, you need to take up something jolly.
Yeah, something jolly. Yeah, something like that.
And then you could cheer up Bruce in your spare time.
I'm quite jolly, actually.
Yeah, you do seem to be strangely jolly.
I speak in a dark way, but I'm one of the happiest writers I know.
You do speak in a dark way and a very happy tone of voice. It's odd, isn't it? Are you genuinely optimistic?
No, I really don't do that.
You don't do optimism?
I don't do pessimism either.
You just do what is.
I'm engaged.
No, you do what will be.
Yes, I do what will be. That's it. I'm looking for weak indicators, kind of signals on the ground. I think if you approach that from an optimistic or pessimistic perspective, you will never understand what's happening. I mean, you really just sort of need to be engaged with objective reality there and not be blinded by personal hopes.
Because
you need a historical perspective.
Because personal hopes is investing too much, you mean?
Well,
and just skews your judgment.
You know, if you were to ask a historian if he were optimistic or pessimistic about the 19th century, you know, he would simply laugh at you. I mean, the 19th century had dark elements and bright elements, but, you know, a lot depends on the spin and interpretation. And, you know, when I look at events in troubled parts of the world, I don't feel overwhelmed by it. I'm certainly much more optimistic than most fellow Americans I know about America's financial situation because I have seen abject economic collapse. I mean, I've really seen the entire doctrine just come apart at the seams. I've seen people tear a hole in the flag. I've seen them, like, loot police headquarters, you know, just, like, blow it, you know, and then come out better off, you know, in some ways or at least differently and still very human, you know. So, you know, I think America is in many ways the slave of its almighty dollar. And this is just, you know, part of the American national character. And the Americans are in for some growthful learning experiences here.
Just as a matter of interest, when you both grow old and frail and unable to have such a large carbon footprint.
Yes.
Where will you decide to live permanently?
Well, this is a matter we've often discussed, actually.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think I can answer that question. You know, I don't want to. I don't think in permanent ways.
I don't think we're going to get to planet.
Yeah.
You know, really, most of the things that are important in our joint life have just they've been black swans. They've absolutely come out of nowhere. I mean, people just offer us things to do. You know, things show up. The important developments are beyond any rational planning.
I think, you know, for me it's a problem because I grew up in many countries, you know.
So did I, actually.
So did you. But you see, I grew up in many languages also. So when I live only in Serbia, I miss my Italian part, you know. And also, I went to English boarding school all my life. I grew up in Italy, in Cairo, and I spoke Serbian in my family. So when I settle in one place, you know, not to speak about other languages and other places, I miss the other part. It's like cutting something away from me. This is why I can't imagine saying, this is my homeland. I'm going to grow up. You know, I want to die in my boots, as Robert Louis Stevenson said, and did. Yes.
Jasmina Tasanovic and Bruce Sterling here for the Webstock Conference.